Chapter 8. Emptiness which had made me so restless for the last few months lost its bitter plausibility, its evil influence, dissolved in a flow of joyous emotion. At first glance I saw that she was a high-class vessel, a harmonious creature in the lines of her fine body, in the proportioned tallness of her spars. Whatever her age and her history, S.E. had preserved the stamp of her origin. She was one of those craft that, in virtue of their design and complete finish, will never look old. Amongst her companions moored to the bank, and all bigger than herself, she looked like a creature of high breed, an Arab steed in a string of cart horses. A voice behind me said in a nasty equivocal tone, "I hope you are satisfied with her, Captain." I did not even turn my head. It was the master of the steamer, and whatever he meant, whatever he thought of her, I knew that, like some rare women, she was one of those creatures whose mere existence is enough to awaken an unselfish delight. One feels that it is good to be in the world in which she has her being. That illusion of life and character which charms one in men's finest handiwork radiated from her. An enormous bulk of teak wood timber swung over her hatchway. Lifeless matter, looking heavier and bigger than anything aboard of her. When they started lowering it, the surge of the tackle sent a quiver through her from waterline to the trucks up the fine nerves of her rigging, as though S.E. had shuddered at the weight. It seemed cruel to load her so. Half an hour later, putting my foot on her deck for the first time, I received the feeling of deep physical satisfaction. Nothing could equal the fullness of that moment, the ideal completeness of that emotional experience which had come to me without the preliminary toil and disenchantments of an obscure career. My rapid glance ran over her, enveloped, appropriated the form concreting the abstract sentiment of my command. A lot of details perceptible to a seaman struck my eye, vividly in that instant. For the rest, I saw her disengaged from the material conditions of her being. The shore to which she was moored was as if it did not exist. What were to me all the countries of the globe? In all the parts of the world washed by navigable waters, our relation to each other would be the same, and more intimate than there are words to express in the language. Apart from that, every scene and episode would be a mere passing show. The very gang of yellow coolies busy about the main hatch was less substantial than the stuff dreams are made of. For who on earth would dream of Chinamen? I went aft, ascended the poop, where, under the awning, gleamed the brasses of the yacht-like fittings, the polished surfaces of the rails, the glass of the skylights. Right aft two seamen, busy cleaning the steering gear, with the reflected ripples of light running playfully up their bent backs, went on with their work, unaware of me, and of the almost affectionate glance I threw at them in passing toward the companionway of the cabin. The door stood wide open, the slide was pushed right back. The half turn of the staircase cut off the view of the lobby. A low humming ascended from below, but it stopped abruptly at the sound of my descending footsteps. 3. The first thing I saw down there was the upper part of a man's body projecting backward, as it were, from one of the doors at the foot of the stairs. His eyes looked at me very wide and still. In one hand he held a dinner plate, in the other a cloth. "I am your new captain," I said quietly. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, he had got rid of the plate and the cloth and jumped to open the cabin door. As soon as I passed into the saloon he vanished, but only to reappear instantly, buttoning up a jacket he had put on with the swiftness of a hook change artist. "Where's the chief mate?" I asked. "In the hold, I think, sir. I saw him go down the after hatch 10 minutes ago. Tell him I am on board." The mahogany table under the skylight shone in the twilight like a dark pool of water. The sideboard, surmounted by a wide-looking glass in an ormolu frame, had a marble top. It bore a pair of silver-plated lamps, and some other pieces, obviously a harbor display. The saloon itself was paneled in two kinds of wood in the excellent simple taste prevailing when the ship was built. I sat down in the armchair at the head of the table, the captain's chair, with a small telltale compass swung above it, a mute reminder of unremitting vigilance. A succession of men had sat in that chair. I became aware of that thought suddenly, vividly, as though each had left a little of himself between the four walls of these ornate bulkheads. As if a sort of composite soul, the soul of command, had whispered suddenly to mine of long days at sea, and of anxious moments. You too, it seemed to say, you too, shall taste of that peace and that unrest in a searching intimacy with your own self, obscure as we were, and as supreme in the face of all the winds and all the seas, in an immensity that receives no impress, preserves no memories, and keeps no reckoning of lives. Deep within the tarnished Ormulu frame, in the hot half-light sifted through the yawning, I saw my own face propped between my hands. And I stared back at myself with the perfect detachment of distance, rather with curiosity than with any other feeling, except of some sympathy for this latest representative of what for all intents and purposes was a dynasty, continuous not in blood indeed, but in its experience, in its training, in its conception of duty, and in the blessed simplicity of its traditional point of view on life. It struck me that this quietly staring man whom I was watching, both as if he were myself and somebody else, was not exactly a lonely figure. He had his place in a line of men whom he did not know, of whom he had never heard, but who were fashioned by the same influences, whose souls in relation to their humble life's work had no secrets for him. Suddenly I perceived that there was another man in the saloon, standing a little on one side and looking intently at me. The chief mate. His long, red mustache determined the character of his physiognomy, which struck me as pugnacious in, strange to say, a ghastly sort of way. How long had he been there looking at me, appraising me in my unguarded daydreaming state? I would have been more disconcerted if, having the clock set in the top of the mirror frame right in front of me, I had not noticed that its long hand had hardly moved at all. I could not have been in that cabin more than 2 minutes altogether. Say 3. So he could not have been watching me more than a mere fraction of a minute, luckily. Still, I regretted the occurrence. But I showed nothing of it as I rose leisurely, it had to be leisurely, and greeted him with perfect friendliness. There was something reluctant, and at the same time attentive in his bearing. His name was Burns. We left the cabin, and went round the ship together. His face in the full light of day appeared very pale, meager, even haggard. Somehow I had a delicacy as to looking too often at him. His eyes, on the contrary, remained fairly glued on my face. They were greenish, and had an expectant expression. He answered all my questions readily enough, but my ear seemed to catch a tone of unwillingness. The second officer, with 3 or 4 hands, was busy forward. The mate mentioned his name, and I nodded to him in passing. He was very young. He struck me as rather a cub. When we returned below, I sat down on one end of a deep, semi-circular, or, rather, semi-oval settee, upholstered in red plush. It extended right across the whole after end of the cabin. Mr. Burns motioned to sit down, dropped into one of the swivel chairs round the table, and kept his eyes on me as persistently as ever, and with that strange air, as if all this were make-believe, and he expected me to get up, burst into a laugh, slap him on the back, and vanish from the cabin. There was an odd stress in the situation which began to make me uncomfortable. I tried to react against this vague feeling. It's only my inexperience, I thought. In the face of that man, several years, I judged, older than myself, I became aware of what I had left already behind me, my youth. And that was indeed poor comfort. Youth is a fine thing, a mighty power, as long as one does not think of it. I felt I was becoming self-conscious. Almost against my will I assumed a moody gravity. I said, I see you have kept her in very good order, Mr. Burns. Directly I had uttered these words I asked myself angrily, why the deuce did I want to say that? Mr. Burns in answer had only blinked at me. What on earth did he mean? I fell back on a question which had been in my thoughts for a long time, the most natural question on the lips of any seaman whatever joining a ship. I voiced it, confound this self-consciousness, in a digit cheerful tone, I suppose she can travel what? Now a question like this might have been answered normally, either in accents of apologetic sorrow, or with a visibly suppressed pride, in a don't want to boast, but you shall see, sort of tone. There are sailors too, who would have been roughly outspoken, lazy brute, or openly delighted, she's a flyer. Two ways, if four manners. But Mr. Burns found another way, a way of his own which had, at all events, the merit of saving his breath, if no other. Again he did not say anything. He only frowned. And it was an angry frown. I waited. Nothing more came. What's the matter? Can't you tell after being nearly 2 years in the ship? I addressed him sharply. He looked as startled for a moment, as though he had discovered my presence, only that very moment. But this passed off almost at once. He put on an air of indifference. But I suppose he thought it better to say something. He said that a ship needed, just like a man, the chance to show the best she could do, and that this ship had never had a chance, since he had been on board of her. Not that he could remember. The last captain. He paused. Has he been so very unlucky? I asked with frank incredulity. Mr. Burns turned his eyes away from me. No, the late captain was not an unlucky man. One couldn't say that. But he had not seemed to want to make use of his luck. Mr. Burns, man of enigmatic moods, made this statement with an inanimate face and staring willfully at the rudder casing. The statement itself was obscurely suggestive. I asked quietly. Where did he die? In this saloon. Just where you are sitting now, answered Mr. Burns. I repressed a silly impulse to jump up, but upon the whole I was relieved to hear that he had not died in the bed which was now to be mine. I pointed out to the chief mate that what I really wanted to know was where he had buried his late captain. Mr. Burns said that it was at the entrance to the gulf. A roomy grave. A sufficient answer. But the mate, overcoming visibly something within him, something like a curious reluctance to believe in my advent as an irrevocable fact, at any rate, did not stop at that, though, indeed, he may have wished to do so. As a compromise with his feelings, I believe, he addressed himself persistently to the rudder casing, so that to me, he had the appearance of a man talking in solitude. A little unconsciously, however. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.